same great show, brand new time slot. The Monday mixtape has moved to Monday morning, 7 a.m., so you can start your work day the right way with me, your host, Jesse Bell, as we are curating a playlist around a central theme each and every single week. Mondays are rough, but you can make them a lot better by tuning into the Monday Mixtape, Monday mornings, 7 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
I had a conversation with a client when we were putting together an application back in January. You know, I asked if I could call his brother in Gaza, and he said, no, you can't call right now because he doesn't have good service in the house. He only has service on the roof. But if you stand on the roof, you become a target. And so there's only certain times of the day when they know that there's no shooting that he can stand on the roof. And this is not that time right now. So there are people who went through that to apply for this program, and they're still waiting.
I'm Karen Pugliese, Canada Land Editor-in-Chief. Can you imagine climbing up onto the roof of your home in battle-ravaged Gaza, trying to get a cell signal, just desperately hoping to get into the queue to temporarily escape and come to Canada? We set up a program just for that. For Gazans to get temporary visas to Canada to seek safety. Now, we've had programs like this before many times for people in Ukraine, Afghanistan, Syria. So Immigration Minister Mark Miller promised visas for 1,000 Gazans in January and then upped that number to 5,000 in May. It's supposed to help Gazans get to Egypt and from there to Canada. Now, do you know how many Gazans made it to Canada since January? Well, 206. 206 people. But here's the thing. They didn't exactly get out of Gaza through the program. Those 206 people managed to get from Gaza to Egypt through a network of smugglers and bribes. Now, Canada helped them from there, but that's not how it's supposed to work. Canada's supposed to be able to get Gazans out bribe-free and through its official channels. And that's not working. Even Minister Miller said so. Do you know how many people have gotten out of Gaza legally and officially? In April, CBC reported that number. Zero. Yeah, zero. Zero people made it out through the official program. In May, the Globe and Mail confirmed that number again. Now, I'm thinking of that man climbing up on his roof, in between bombs dropping, trying to reach a lawyer in Canada, thinking he's getting out through this program. Does he know no one's made it? And why hasn't anyone? What the hell is going on? Cherise Sushran is going to tell us. Wait for it.
That story you heard at the top of the show about the man climbing on his roof to get cell signal. The person telling that story is Adam Sadinsky, and he was referring to the brother of a client. Sadinsky is an immigration and refugee lawyer. He's also the co-chair of the Advocacy Committee of the Canadian Association of Refugee Lawyers. He joined me on a call from his office in Toronto.
I represent a decent number of clients from Gaza. Both who have applied through the special measures that the government announced in December, but also people who are here in Canada and trying to stay in Canada.
He said it was important to know that this immigration pathway isn't a refugee program.
In this case, we're not talking about refugees. The individuals who are applying through this program would receive visitor visas. This is not a permanent program. It's not for permanent protection.
So it's a visitor visa providing temporary residence for up to 3 years with the idea that people would eventually return home. A similar temporary pathway was created for Ukrainians in 2022, resulting in over 200,000 Ukrainians coming to Canada. So why hasn't the Gaza program been as successful? To understand, I asked Sadinsky to take me through the application process as he would to a client.
Well, the first thing that they would need is they need to have a family member in Canada. That's how you qualify for this program.
That family member would swear a declaration that they're going to provide financial support and also help with settlement in Canada.
The next thing that you receive is a special code, a unique code that you use to apply for your visa online.
The code essentially confirms that you have the elements in place to be eligible. It gives you access to the next step, a much longer application, which determines if you're actually eligible for the program.
And then your application goes to IRCC for processing, and that's where they're going to determine whether you actually qualify for this program.
And here's where things get a bit complicated. With a regular visa application, if you get approved, then the next step would be to give biometrics, like fingerprints, at a visa office in your home country. But that can't work here because there isn't one in Gaza. So applicants have to leave to get those biometric checks completed.
Then the way the program is supposed to work is Canada lets you know, hey, it's time for you to leave Gaza. We're very likely going to approve your application, proceed to the border at Rafah with Egypt. Then you're going to go into Egypt, probably get on a bus, and we'll put you up in a hotel for a couple of nights so that you can come and do biometrics at the embassy in Cairo. And then Canada does some additional security checks. And as long as everything checks out, then you get your visa in Cairo, and then you can travel to Canada.
And that's what would happen in a regular scenario. But clearly not this one. It is very difficult to leave Gaza. At the time the visa program was implemented earlier this year, the only potential route out of Gaza was at the Rafah border crossing into Egypt. And Egypt had an agreement with Israel in which Israel could approve who could cross that border. So under Israel's Ministry of Defense, there is a department called COGAT, which stands for Coordination of Government Activities in the Territories, which is responsible for overseeing who goes in and out of Rafah. Canada knew people would have to make it over the tightly controlled Rafah crossing. So Canada has sent COGAT lists of people who have been approved for the visa application, with the idea that COGAT would review and ideally allow those people to exit. But it hasn't really worked that way.
The number of people who have been successful through that process, where Canada tells you, yes, you can leave, we're going to help you cross the border from Gaza into Egypt, I don't know of anyone who was successful through that process.
So it's zero.
It's my understanding. And to date, the Israeli government has not approved a single person to cross from Gaza into Egypt.
And would you say this is the biggest problem that's happening right now with this program?
I would say yes. You know, even if Canada processed all of these applications and Canada gave all of the approvals that they needed, if people aren't able to go over the border and they can't get to Egypt, then they also can't get to Canada.
Zadinsky said that the number of people who have been approved to cross the border is, to his knowledge, zero. Earlier news reports say this as well. So I reached out to Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship Canada. They did not confirm directly that the number was zero, but what they did tell me was that as of August 17th, 450 people have exited Gaza on their own, completed their application, and been approved for the visa. 206 have now completed the final step and made it all the way to Canada. So how exactly have they gotten here?
There has been a fair amount of smuggler activity on the Gaza-Egypt border. And this is in the days before the Israeli capture of Rafah. The people were paying tons and tons of money to smugglers, companies, which would allow them to get over the border, not through the regular process. A couple hundred people who were able to leave Gaza through that route made their way on to Egypt, and some of those people have ended up in Canada now.
Just a couple of months after the program started, Immigration Minister Mark Miller expressed his frustration at the situation.
This is a program that we knew from the get-go could be a failure. Up to now, it is a failure, and it's something I think we need to recognize.
However, in May, Israel seized the Rafah crossing, and according to reports, the border has been effectively closed to people trying to leave. even through smuggling.
The Israeli military says its forces have taken control of the Palestinian side of the Rafah crossing, which borders Egypt and southern Gaza.
In response to growing concerns from advocates like Sadinsky, Minister Mark Miller announced at the end of May an expansion to the Gaza program, increasing the cap to 5,000 and expanding eligibility. But the Rafah crossing is still closed, and thousands of applications are still pending, even new ones being created.
There's a lot of people today sitting in Gaza who've had applications pending for 7 months, or, you know, have passed through everything that they've needed to do, and frankly, not easily.
What should Canada be doing now? And what happens to those who are waiting? One mother from Gaza says that she doesn't want what happened to her daughter to happen to anyone else.
And I was trying so hard to get her, like, kind of like expedite the process for her, because she was a child, a minor, she was handicapped.
Due to the war, it's difficult to actually get in touch with someone in Gaza applying to this visa program. However, there are people in Canada who say they know what they're going through.
We moved to Canada in 2019, and I was so hopeful that once we step in Canada that we're going to be able to reunite with Jenna. But I was not aware that the immigration process takes years for people to reunite. And for the last 5 years, I've been trying to make that happen.
This is Samar Alikdor. She's standing outside a Liberal campaign office in Montreal, talking to audio producer Tristan Capocchione. There's a protest going on in the background, trying to raise awareness of the violence in Gaza. This isn't the first protest Alikdor has been to, or even the 20th. That's because since March, Alikdor has been out on the streets almost every day. It started as a one-woman sit-in outside Minister Mark Miller's office, which went on for months. And then recently, she started to join larger protests at various political or governmental offices around Montreal. Alikdor is on a mission to compel the minister to expedite the Gaza immigration applications so that no one ends up like her daughter, Jana.
I was so hopeful that once we step in Canada that we're going to be able to reunite with Jana.
Alikdor came to Canada in 2019 after completing her studies in the U.S. She was able to bring over her husband and two other children, but she says that her daughter, Jana, was not able to leave. That's because Jana was born with cerebral palsy, a developmental disability, as well as brain damage, and she required extensive care. Alikdor says getting her out of Gaza safely required special transportation, so in the meantime, relatives in Gaza were taking care of her. But immigration had delayed her application for a very long time, and when the war broke out, Alikdor became desperate.
And I was trying so hard to get her, like, kind of like expedite the process for her, because she was a child, a minor, she was handicapped. But still, the response was like, we have to respect the process and delays and all of that.
Alikdor says that when Gaza City was under siege in January, Jana and her relatives sheltered in a church. As has been reported, access to medicine and food were difficult during the siege. Then, she says, the unthinkable happened.
And since my daughter, she had a cerebral palsy problem, so she had to have soft food, certain type of food that she could consume. And what happened is that she starved to death, and she had no access to her medication that she needed at the time.
Just a few days after her daughter passed, Alikdor says she finally heard back from immigration officials, letting her know her daughter would be able to come to Canada. But of course, it was too late. Alikdor wants to make sure no one in Gaza has to experience what her daughter experienced, waiting for word from immigration for months and months. And that's why she spent months trying to get the ministry to move these new temporary visa applications forward. Because in addition to the issues leaving Gaza, people have been waiting to know if they're eligible for the Canadian visa, including some people who applied when the program opened in January 2024. In fact, some Canadian lawyers have submitted a group litigation case to the federal court asking for the Ministry of Immigration to address applications that have been held up for months. The lawyers represent approximately 40 people in Gaza who have all submitted applications and not received codes or updates of their status. Maureen Silkoff is a refugee lawyer based in Toronto. However, she is not associated with the group I mentioned above. Silkoff says that while people in Gaza cannot leave due to the Rafah border being closed, the program may be giving Gazans the impression that Canada could help them leave. She says that while the application warns that people are not guaranteed to leave, it does not in fact make it clear that absolutely no one has been let through this process.
It seems that people were told when they applied that there was a bit of a disclaimer that third parties had to vet, so exit could not be guaranteed. But that's somewhat different from transparency as to whether there was any kind of agreement already in place. The program opened in January. It's been some time since the program opened. What's the update? Are there assurances that are in place now? What's happened in terms of the Rafah crossing being closed? What communication do people have? What efforts have the government made?
We're both looking at the IRCC website as I talk to her on the phone.
I think there should be two notifications. We depend on COGAT vetting, and there hasn't been any vetting yet, and the crossing is closed. And so I think there are two very practical blockages to people exiting, and those should be clear.
I don't see any of those notifications that she mentioned. Silkoff said that it's about fairness to people in a time of crisis. Because while Canada does not have an obligation to bring Gazans over, they are electing to offer this special program and thus engaging in the lives and hopes of people in a crisis.
Because it ends up being basically an access to justice issue, I think, right? If you have a program in place for vulnerable people, it's a humanitarian program, it's in keeping with Canada's humanitarian obligations. But again, it's a question of whether this is procedurally fair, whether there's people's expectations are being managed, and what the information is that's going out to people as the situation unfolds.
Silkoff worked on cases of people from Afghanistan, and she said that Canada has been in this situation before. There was a program to bring people who had worked with the Canadian government over to Canada before the Taliban took over in 2021. But after the Taliban took over, those people, who were more at risk of harm by the Taliban, were essentially left behind.
And the Canadian policies for Afghanistan specified that because of the work of the interpreters, because of the work of people with the embassy, with Canada, they were at risk of not just harm, but even assassination by the Taliban and other groups. So Canada essentially put people at that risk. So Canada needed to do better in that situation. There are still people whose applications fell into a black hole, who never heard anything, who have pending applications, whose processing was delayed. And we don't want that situation replicated for the people of Gaza who have applied under the program.
And Canada should have learned from that, says Silkoff.
I think the situation is foreseeable. And I think it makes it all the more urgent to have transparency in terms of the program.
Where do we go from here? A spokesperson for the IRCC, Jeffrey McDonald, said in a statement that Canada has continued to put forward names of people who passed preliminary eligibility to the local authorities. But he said challenges leaving Gaza are out of Canada's control and that Canada will continue to work with local authorities to facilitate these exits.
I mean, looking at this program overall and the problems we've talked about and the almost impossibility of leaving Gaza at this point, has Canada given Gazans false hope through this?
To a certain extent, yes. Because the government was enthusiastic about this program. Lots of thousands of people applied, but there's another level. And that level is approvals from COGAT. And if people don't get that, then they can't leave. So in terms of creating a program, promoting a program, encouraging people to apply for a program that relies on an approval from a third-party government, that you don't have any assurances of whether that third-party government is going to review and approve the applications that you need to be approved and reviewed. You know, I don't think that the government should shut the program down, but I'm not sure that if someone were to apply today, the hope of being accepted anytime soon, or if at all, is not particularly high.
That's your Candleland. You can email me at Karen@candleland.com. Our website is candleland.com. Today's show was reported by Cherise Sushrin. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. Additional field recording by Tristan Capicchioni. Max Collins is our production manager. I'm Karen Pugliese, Candleland's editor-in-chief. Theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Teacher and TikToker Frank Dominic.
How's it going?
It's real good. It's good to have you here. Listen, today on the show, the selling of Kamala Harris and Canada. Yeah. Pierre Poilievre pulls a patriotic vision of our great nation out of his ass and then hastily shoves it right back up there.
He really did try with the Jets. It's really what he was going for.
Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk about the news.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. We begin in the U.S., where a newly energized Democratic Party is poised to officially nominate Kamala Harris.
Well, lots of eyes in Canada on what is happening right now in Chicago.
People, we are moving forward with optimism.
Frank, as I said, this is where we talk about the news in Canada. But this week, all of the news in Canada is shit about America.
There's just too much stuff going on with the U.S. election, like especially whenever it's a Trump election. It's like we have to stay focused because this affects all of us.
It is engrossing and things keep happening and it's super dramatic. The Canadian media is all in, and not just in coverage, but in the story that they're telling. Let me review some of these headlines here. Globe and Mail. Welcome to Kamala Land. In her home base of L.A., excitement for the Harris campaign is infectious. Another Globe and Mail. Republicans can't land a punch on Kamala Harris. Another Globe and Mail. The Democrats are going into their convention gleeful and united.
Gleeful and united.
Toronto Star. Will women embrace Kamala Harris? Experts say that she's injecting a shot of adrenaline. CBC, a bit more muted, but the bent is the same. The Harris Show. Democratic convention is a primetime debut for surprise nominee. Also CBC, a Harris presidency would have a soft spot for Canada, says our ambassador. Even in the National Post, John Iveson, can the foundering federal liberals pull a Kamala out of their hat, always finding the Canadian connection? There is just a complete love affair with this narrative that there is this surge of excitement.
Yeah, big energy. Like it's, you know what, it's funny because there's a lot of people who are like flashbacking to Hillary, right? And I don't think that's the case, but I bet what we're going to start seeing is a lot of articles coming out, and it's going to be either comparing Kamala and post-DNC to either Hillary or to Trudeau after 2015, right? Like sunny ways, 2015, everything's fantastic. And then like the 2021 election, it was like, whatever, I guess we have to do this.
I've gotten so jaded and questioning of any moment when there is such a market demand for a certain story. It was looking so grim. With like, I can't believe Trump is back.
again.
I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe everything they've thrown at him and the court cases and the felony conviction and then somebody tried to shoot him. And then Biden, oh my God, what a train wreck. We are heading for disaster. And there's such an emotional need for somebody to come and save us. And now all of a sudden it's like, oh, here it is. And it's big Obama vibes of hopey, changey. And like, it's hitting a spot for me too of like, I needed to feel like, wow, I'm glad that these fine people exist and are in positions of leadership. And I think that that is such an attractive narrative for people that I'm suspicious of it. And yes, the fact that we were told again and again and again that Hillary was a lock and everybody had that wrong has absolutely collapsed my faith. I guess my question is, it's the media's job to just give us information and tell us what's happening. Are we being told a story or sold a story?
So the Daily Show actually did something really interesting yesterday. I'll start there. They were talking about, and it was a joke piece, but they were going around the DNC talking about the vibes.
Every convention has a theme, and this year's Democratic convention is all about the vibes.
What's the vibes here at the convention?
Upbeat.
Sparkling. Sparkling. Yeah.
Positive.
I'm all about the motivating vibe.
Let's get it done.
Are you feeling electric?
I do feel electric.
Don't shock me. That's a little electric there.
I think the difference between media and social media and what we're seeing with regular people is the vibe check. Is the vibe check there? So when we talk about Hillary, everyone thought, yeah, Hillary is a lock. I also thought she was a lock, but I didn't like her. I didn't care anything at all about American politics because it just felt bland and boring. The second she said, Pokemon, go to the polls, I was like, done. I was out. I'm like, this is, I don't want to talk about American
politics. Well, you're
being
spoken to like you're an idiot child. Like, it's just...
Well, and she's so out of touch, right? Like,
it's cringy and bad.
But not cringy in the good way, because there is like good cringy. There's like good millennial cringe out there. And she did not embody any of it. Whereas Kamala Harris, I think, is doing a much better job of tapping into like the good side of cringe. Like, when people try to make fun of her laughing, when people try to make fun of her having a good time, why are you trying to put somebody down for like smiling? Like, Trump is always miserable and Biden and was only smiling when he was eating ice cream. Now you have somebody who's happy to actually be campaigning.
She looks great, but we're talking about vibes.
All vibes.
And Canada is swallowing it. Like, listen to this. This is an editorial board op-ed from the Globe and Mail. This is the official position of the paper of record. And the title is The Return of, Dare We Say It, Optimism to Politics. The Democrats' optimism begins with Mr. Biden's decision to step aside and endorse his Vice President Kamala Harris. Mr. Biden put his party and his country before his own interests, and he did it on the biggest political stage in the world. It was a moment that represented politics at its potential best. And of course, they connect this to Canada. Should this optimism continue and translate into her victory in November, it would challenge the notion that voters are best guided to the ballot box by outrage and anger. And they directly connect this to like what's going to happen here. Okay, so that's one story. That Biden is this American hero who stepped aside and did this patriotic thing.
And allowed for a new generation, blah, 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 because he said he was going to be the transitional candidate. And now it's happening and people are excited.
There's another story, which is that he was forced out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, there's definitely, you can, once you start putting the pieces together, it definitely seems like that happened. And I think it was for the best interest, not just of the Democratic Party, but for America as a whole and for like democracy.
Here's an alternate take that I actually appreciate. And it's also in the Globe and Mail from Conrad Jakubowski. I think that it's usually more useful to have a contrary take, especially if it's not just for the sake of being contrary, but like just to say the same thing everybody else is saying. And everybody is saying the same thing, it seems, in Canadian media. Not Conrad Jakubowski. Here's what he wrote. Can Kamala Harris sustain the momentum until November? The vice president had faced the worst media coverage of any second in command since Dan Quayle. Not even Dick Cheney got less respect from the press than her. From her bid for the 2020 Democratic nomination, which flopped spectacularly, to her rocky vice presidential tenure, Ms. Harris systematically raised doubts about her political skills, judgment, and authenticity. Nobody wants to hear this now, but this is what the story was up until a couple months ago.
And so that's the thing. So her first interview, that was like the one that everyone like references as being like this catastrophic interview. And I think it was from that moment in time that Biden decided, yeah, we're going to keep her on the side. We're not going to really profile her as much. And while that might have been a hamper to her in many people's eyes, like, oh, well, she's not liked because she hasn't been around because people haven't gotten used to her, she was able to relaunch her campaign. And it doesn't matter if you're left or right, people are willing to see that relaunch.
You're still just talking about feelings and vibes. And this is what Conrad kind of ends with in his piece. To win in November, Ms. Harris will need to do more than coast on her newfound image as the fun candidate with a fun former football coach as her running mate. Most Americans are not really in the mood for fun these days. They are pessimistic about the economy and the security of their country. I like that he's talking to his readers like grownups, right? There is a different story than whether Kamala Harris has a nice laugh and is a charming person. And she certainly is. And she seems to be able to, like, dodge the punches, and Trump can't make a nickname stick. This is all true. And it's filling some sort of an emotional
need.
But
what makes her better? Like, what actually is there? You're talking about, like, the substantive policy side?
I'm saying that when we look at this from Canada, we are watching the U.S.-American presidential election show.
Yeah.
We are not the constituency who this matters
to. Oh, no, we're not voting. We're watching, and maybe it does affect our lives, but we don't have any say of how it rolls out.
Yes. So there's a different lens that many Americans might look at this through, which is to say, here we have the Democratic establishment. If there was a fear, and conspiracy people would call it the deep state, but other people just call it the establishment, that we were being mismanaged, misled, and kind of lied to, that everything that Obama promised in Hopi changiness, like, things have not gotten better, and the income disparity
only, like, getting wider. Yeah.
The vibe has not been met with actual policy, and you're not really sure what's going on. And then the debate comes and you're like, oh my God, this is a weekend at Bernie's president. Like, they've been lying to us. The lie has been revealed, because in a debate situation, you can't keep that secret anymore. So now the machinery of the establishment moves in. And what do we get? The Clintons, the Obamas.
They're all coming out in full force.
Yeah. This is telling us, this is the same person who nobody had time for yesterday. And this is the same Democratic Party that schemed and connived to make sure that Bernie Sanders was not the candidate. And whatever anyone wants to say about Trump, he is the candidate despite the machinations of the establishment.
Like, not because of the establishment.
That's right. He was fueled by people power. I mean, the darker side of people power.
Yeah, and the Canadian angle to that, if you want to talk about, like, how does that affect us, is Pierre, just like Trump, really wasn't the establishment. Like, I mean, like, him and Harper had that connection, but a lot of establishment conservatives, a lot of pre-merger conservatives, did not like Pierre. They did not want Pierre to be the lead. Pierre capitalized at the right time. He waited for a couple people to go up first and kind of make their fails, jumped in at the right time. And he wasn't born into politics. He wasn't born into wealth and power. So I do see that parallel. I do understand why people see that. And they some people who might be inspired by Pierre and that side of things. But, like, Trudeau, more like Trump when you think about it, born into wealth, born into power, given all of these opportunities. And once again, when Trudeau in 2015 came on board, the Liberals were the third party, right? Like, it was going to be Layton. And then, unfortunately, cancer took one of the best politicians from us. But Trudeau stepped up and he inspired people, right? I remember being young and in 2015 and being excited for Trudeau.
That was a vibe campaign during a time where optimism was perhaps, like, warranted based on where people were at economically. There is a larger macro global trend that is, I think, economic in nature, but, like, it is showing itself in the form of right-leaning populism. And what we're being told now is, no, there's a vibe that's more powerful than that. And that's, I guess, what I'm skeptical of. You get the sense that what happened with Hillary was the media was, whether this was, like, by design or just the way things work, we're going to say this so much that it becomes true. There's a lot of hot air, but maybe eventually the hot air becomes a hot air balloon that lifts and takes off. And they said, this, she's a lock. And then it turned out, because at the time, there was still the concept that CNN et al. Had the influence to just, if they keep just hitting you in the head with this message, it will become true. The actual electoral politics of this is that all of this pro-Kamala messaging, the crux of it is on a teeny amount of wedge voters in wedge states.
Yep, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. If they can really hammer it there, then they win.
That's who all this is for. And it's like, can she get the women out who were not enthused by Biden? And that might make it a reality. Is Trump not watching this and just trying to plan? He's great at just disrupting things.
Here's the funny thing. And so I was talking to somebody who does political strategy at a smaller level in the U.S. through DMs on Twitter. And I was asking them about, like why is the Democrats seemingly doing all these, like, celebrity things and all these, like, headline grabbing things that, like, was really out of the norm for them, even in the Obama era when they were so popular. And it's basically like, this is the anti-Trump weapon. This will not be the DNC forever. This will not be the Democratic Party forever. This is the anti-Trump weapon right now, because Trump hates it when he's not in the news. He hates it when he's not the center of attention. And no matter what he says, no matter what crazy things that he's doing right now, people aren't focusing on him. They're just headline after headline after headline about the Democrats. And that might fade. But right now, he is pissed. And what that's going to do is that's going to put him off kilter. He is going to start saying things that aren't really going to grab the headlines as much as they're just going to piss people off. He is just going to do whatever he can, like a child. Like I have a 3-year-old. When she wants attention, she throws a damn tantrum. And sometimes it's cute. Sometimes it's funny. Most of the times it's not. And Trump is really entering that it's not funny, it's not cute anymore phase. Like, I think people, it's really kind of worn off its welcome.
I think you got to give credit to where he is. I don't know if the word is talent or genius or whatever it is about him that has an innate sense of the zeitgeist and where things are at. You're absolutely right that he's emotionally driven. But his sense of, like, okay, there's a mood right now, I can't seem to disrupt it or make anything stick against her. But that's going to fade. And there's going to be a little moment where the opportunity is going to exist for him. And maybe it'll be like a flailing tantrum like you suggest. But he's pretty good at getting attention. With
yeah, let me translate this for I don't know how many Gen Z listeners you guys got. But like basically Trump usually got Sigma Riz. Right now he's got Ohio Riz. It's not working.
No.
This is the problem with being a teacher.
No. This is just save it for TikTok, Frank. Frank, we try to make sure that people do not miss news stories that really should be noted. Do you have a news story to duly note today?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an Ontario teacher, right? So the thing I got to point out is Todd Smith. So Lecce steps down, he's moved out. He didn't want to be Minister of Education.
Stephen Lecce, yeah.
Yeah, and finally Ford listened and he gave him a better posting. So they swapped him out with the Energy Minister. I think a lot of people in education were looking forward to a new minister. The whole summer he's talking about how great and excited he is and looking forward to working with teachers and working with educators and school boards. Literally tweeted that out one day, next day announces his retirement from politics. That's really rattling, I think, to a lot of us, especially because the person he's being replaced with is Jill Dunlop, who, if anybody has paid attention to what's happening in the post-secondary education sector, this is not the person we want running our education system. She was responsible for the mass increase of international students coming into the Ontario College system because they cut so much funding from the Ontario College program. So she is the mastermind behind why Ontario colleges and universities are underfunded. She's the reason why we have so many international students, which is causing housing crises in the GTA. It's causing mass issues in terms of funding at universities. It's why students at Guelph University don't have residence in first year. All these things that are constantly on the minds of parents. And now we have to deal with her in education. I'm not looking forward to that. That's something that really, really upsets me. And I think a lot of people aren't going to be talking about it because A, it's the summer, and B, nobody really pays attention to ministers. But this is something that if you are a parent, you need to keep your eye on this because I think it's going to have an impact.
You know, talking to not just parents, but teachers here in Ontario, like the level of frustration and fury with this government, we're watching this crucial system just getting
beaten down, torn apart.
Duly noted. Okay, I have one to duly note here. This is a CBC story. Manitoba chiefs asked Trudeau and Governor General to rescind Senate appointment of broadcaster Charles Adler. Charles Adler has just been named to the Senate by Trudeau, longtime podcaster, radio host, opinion guy, like decades of this. Turns out that 25 years ago, he made statements referencing Indigenous leaders as uncivilized boneheads and intellectually moribund. The Assembly of Chiefs in Manitoba called this vulgar and racist commentary. And there was actually a complaint about this back in 2000 that was dismissed to the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council. I wanted to bring this up for a couple reasons. Like, it seems to be in the same category as Trudeau's blackface history or Poilievre had said some incredibly offensive
things. It was 25 years ago, right? Like, but Adler was an adult when he said it. He wasn't a teenager, right? Like, how old was Adler 25 years ago? He was still, what, in his 40s?
Certainly an adult who should be held responsible for the things that he says. Here's my take on this, which is not an excuse for... First of all, there's a little bit of nuance missing here. Like when the Assembly of Chiefs says like that he called Native people uncivilized boneheads, that's a little bit...
It was just the leadership he was talking about,
he
right?
He was talking about the leadership. And I think that in any other context for a broadcaster opinion person to call... If you're talking about leaders, governors, and say they're uncivilized boneheads, if you're talking about Ottawa that way, it would be no big deal. This might have just been a snafu of like that is not the right word to use in the context given the history
that
of
framing, yeah.
That framing. So you might let him off. But there's worse stuff he said. He said like something about how the Indigenous people need to get a job. Certainly, I think, like racist stuff in his past. My ultimate take on this is not, let the guy off the hook. He should be a senator. It's fine with me if this is disqualifying. It's more a defense of like the job of being an opinion person, which I think is almost like antithetical to the job of being a politician. Really, my critique here is of this Canadian practice of turning journalists into senators. If your job is to have opinions about matters of public interest day after day after day, if your job is to criticize the leaders, criticize policy decisions day after day after day and try to engage people by being interesting about them, it is invariable that you will have some bad takes and they're going to be recorded and published for the world to see forever. And that's why I feel like this culture of like, I've graduated from like my sinecure after a career in journalism is to become a senator. I think it's important for people in our line of work to like swear off ever taking public office because we can't be good at this job. We should be conscious about what we say for the job that we're doing. I'm responsible to my job as a broadcaster, not my future career as a politician. And here, I'll put my money where my mouth is here, okay? And this is a message not for our listeners now, but for the low-level political operative who's going through the Jesse Brown archives, because I'm now like 60 and I'm trying to get into the Senate and you're trying to like find something to get me with. Do not give Jesse Brown this office. This is Jesse Brown from the past disqualifying future Jesse Brown. Please play this clip. He should not be in government.
I think he's all right. Maybe not in government, but I think he's a good guy. So duly noted.
Frank, I want to play for you a video that the Conservative Party of Canada does not want you to see. They originally wanted everybody to see it. They publish it. And then within hours after it was absolutely dragged to dirt, it disappeared, which is not something that happens often.
Who would do that?
This wonderful Twitter account, Disordered YYC, actually went through this video and traced back all of these video clips, and the stock footage library tells you where they come from.
Some of it's more egregious than other ones.
I think you and I should let people know the visuals are a big part of this, so we'll annotate this as we play the audio for people. Here's the video that Pierre Poilievre and the Conservative Party of Canada does not want you to see.
Pierre in his cowboy hat?
Yeah, tidy whitey, kind of t-shirt Henley, and a white Stetson.
And it's easy to forget what home and hope look like. So let me paint the picture of school children, boys and girls, being welcomed by their teacher at the front of the school as they walk in to learn about reading, writing, arithmetic, and our proud history. Before walking in the door, though, they look back at Dad in his pickup truck who's dropped them off. He rolls down that suburban street with his window.
It's actually an American suburban street that we're seeing. We have suburbs in Canada. They could have gotten Canadian suburbs.
Canadian lumber on newly built and affordable Canadian homes.
He can hear that it's Canadian lumber somehow.
The house being built, Slovenia.
I thought it looked Slovenian.
He looks out his windows and sees those big, prestigious barley or canola fields.
Barley or canola, whatever, as long as it's not soy. Right, brah?
And he looks up, and what does he see? He sees a brand new fighter jet. They're doing a...
Russian fighter jets?
That's a big one.
Yeah, that's not great.
Later in the day, that whole family come together for a big family celebration because it's been 10 years since one of the adult kids in the family has been sober and overcome his drug addiction, and they gather
it
around...
It seems insensitive to raise glasses of wine to celebrate the guy's sobriety.
Well, it was a drug addict, so...
Okay.
Some wonderful venison that was shot with totally legal Canadian firearms, and they sit...
Apparently shot by an American woman with a rifle there.
The car leaves the driveway, and they turn, and they look west. And what do they see? They see wheat, foothills, Rockies, and a big blue twilight sky.
That's Tuscany.
And seriously?
This is in Tuscany.
That's hilarious. And the most Canadian foothills of Indonesia?
Wonosobo, Indonesia.
And the Rockies that were actually from Utah.
And they look each other in the eye, and they say, we're home. This is...
I mean, I would never have to declare that I'm home.
They both say it to each other at the same time.
Yeah.
Where to even begin? That is Pierre Poilievre's optimism?
Yeah. So he is trying, but I think that he has mired himself in so much negativity over the last 20 years of his political career. Like, he's only known, even when he was in government with Harper, he's only known being a pit bull. And I think he really does struggle with the vibe check of, like, being happy and being inspiring. And I'm sure that there are some people for who that hits. But for the regular Canadian, the people that he needs to win in the 905 for him to get that majority government solid, I don't think it's hitting.
Hard disagree up until the release of this video. I actually have watched I couldn't help but be impressed by the calculus that everybody who follows this stuff was just like shocked and appalled that Poilievre thought he could just trade in his glasses for a tight t-shirt and fool everybody that he's not this like kind of abrasive pencil neck geek. Unpleasant.
It's almost like cartoonish where like the character puts on a mustache and it's like, oh, who are you?
Yeah, like shed the peewee thing and be this like other guy. But they made some very smart decisions. Most people were not paying attention. They never knew that Poilievre. They knew that they had the same opportunity that Kamala has, which is like,
a refresh.
Yeah, like the overall awareness of this person is so low. There's way more people who don't know them than people who do. So why don't we just start fresh and make it the Polyev that suits this moment and not that moment? And to this question of optimism, before Kamala Harris, I watched with some, you know, kind of frightened regard as how he adapted the Trump thing to shave off some of the loonier aspects of it.
And make it more palatable.
He was able to encapsulate the F Trudeau and the hang Trudeau stuff without saying the words and kind of adapting this into like, no, I actually love this country and I've got a strong optimistic view of
it. It's not because we're angry, it's because we're passionate.
I would feel this way and make this argument before this video. And the problem with this video is not just that it uses, like, they could have made this video using Canadian stock footage. It would have been just as stupid. It is worth noting, and it's certainly fun, and we should all make fun of this video, not just because of how much fun it is, but because the fact that his bullshit pastiche of a Canadian utopia is, it feels like it was made by AI.
Yeah, I was like, that's the vibes that I was kind of getting. And what's even funny is like some of the smaller things, like I get that he was in Alberta or wherever he was when he was doing this, but like the words common sense with a cowboy hat in the middle on his podium, like who is this for other than people who are already going to vote for you?
It's so lame and it's so hackneyed and cliched and tossed off and lazy. The fact that the best way that the Conservative Party could think to illustrate this was with stock images is like delicious and should be made
Could there not have been footage of him in a suburb walking past construction? There must have been. You could have done this with Pierre alone.
And the speech on its own, I don't know, I guess it's some intern, like, but they have a lot of money, so it's really hard to figure out. The fact that they pulled it is remarkable here because the way that they have responded to this kind of mockery in the past is doubling down and turning it on their opponents like, oh, the elites are sneering at us again. The media is sneering at us again. They don't get it.
Pierre's not one to apologize, right? Like, he's not really the kind of guy who says, you know what I said was wrong. Like, even when he was a younger member of parliament and he made a few racist comments. So he's never really been one to like fully own an apology and move forward. He very much is like, no, I am the guy. I am right. And for them to delete this is, to me, a sign of cowardice. And what I mean by that is that they are so gung-ho about their idea. They think that they're right. They know that they're right. They're pushing forward. And to be fair, the Trudeau team also always thinks that they're right. And they have their master plan, sure, whatever they think is going to work. But the fact that they deleted this shows me the type of cowardice that we're seeing from Trump now, where he's scared of Kamala, in so much that when there's a little bit of public pushback, when they get ratioed on Twitter, when they're finally made to be seen as fools, all of a sudden now they're like, whoa, 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 we can't be seen like that. Like, when we're foolish and it's our choice, it's different. But when people are actually laughing at us and it's not our choice, that's not great.
I guess. I mean, people have laughed at Pierre many times in the past and he's been able to turn that around and make that a comment on our elitism or our snobbery or our media bias. Besides the fact that this is just fun and Twitter had a fun day with this, I do think it's worth talking about, A, because they took it away. But the really interesting thing to me is that this is a super postmodern speech that he gave. It's super campy, the cowboy cosplay. He's playing to an audience of Albertans, and like, I guess he's like nominally a Western dude, but he's no cowboy. And the white t-shirt and the Stetson is like a costume. And they know it and he knows it. And you kind of realize this at the moment where he's like, he's laying it on so thick. It's Canadian wood and it's Canadian energy and it's Canadian venison shot with a Canadian gun. And they laugh because they know that it's a joke.
Yeah, it's okay to be a little campy. And I think that that actually does work in some capacity.
But how could it be both at the same time? It's really interesting because usually when you would do the like America, I'm going to make fun of a red-blooded American cliche, you are satirizing that patriotic redneck thing. To be pandering to that kind of patriotism while making fun of that kind of patriotism is really interesting. And the fact that that audience was like, ha, 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 that's a bit too much. It's Canadian venison and Canadian this and Canadian that, but we love it. So it's a joke and we're kind of a joke, but we're in on the joke and we love the joke. I mean, it's not even very Canadian. Most of this is just borrowed from American mythology.
So I think we're two Toronto guys, right? Like Ontario is where we are. People make fun of people in Toronto saying that we think they're the center of Canada, blah, blah, blah. blah. But this was designed and created for people in the West. You look West, all these Western things. It was not meant for us. It was meant for the people who feel that Western alienation, those people who supported the Freedom Convoy. Maybe they didn't show up. Maybe they weren't vocally, but they thought to themselves, yeah, let's stick it to the government. I think that's who it's for
sure.
To rile that base up and to keep them committed to the cause.
It's super sophisticated, but for the video that tanked it all, in the way that, like, who loves that Jeff Foxworthy guy, you know, you're a redneck Wen joke? Like, his biggest audience are people from the South, right? So the dynamics of mockery are, if we mock them, we're hated, and it confirms everything that they think.
But when they mock themselves, it's all cool. And
it's a very working man's vision. Like, everybody in his vision of Canada
is an electrician who grabs lightning from the sky and nails wood with their hammers by hand. And, like,
he's been hitting those notes for a long time, like, as if everybody is, that's the honorable work, that the farmers.
And his parents were teachers. And I don't see him ever talking about, like, the hardworking teachers. Like, even when he talks about schools, he doesn't put the emphasis on, like, how hard teachers work. He puts the emphasis on, like, we're going to make schools where, like, things aren't woke. And hey, if we're talking about Canadian workers, the working class is not just people who work with their hands. The working class is, like, the teller at TD. The working class is the person who is stocking the shelves at your local grocery store. The working class are firefighters and police officers and nurses and teachers, but we don't talk about them.
The working class is the poor intern who just got fired for that stock image use.
I think this video would matter in an election. I think if we were paying attention and Canadians were ready to vote and it was, like, the 2024 election, a video like this would strike people as being, like, a little too weird, and, like, especially anybody outside of the West, people in BC, people in Ontario and Quebec and in the Atlantics, it would be, like, kind of, like, cringy in a not good way. But because it's so far out of the election season, nobody cares, nobody's going to remember this, and it's gonna blow over.
It's going to blow over. Good news for Pierre. Optimism is back.
Optimism's back, baby.
That's Shortcuts this week. Frank, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
I can be emailed, as always, at jesse@canadaland.com. I read every email that people send in. Frank Dominic, where can people find you?
Mainly on TikTok at Frank Dominic, DOMENIC. And you can find me on YouTube and Twitter and on Instagram, wherever. I got reposting. I repost everywhere.
Frank's TikTok is worth your time. Go check it out. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Yeah. Who's some new salute to?
Smolam shnu chal kula.